He signed the NATO pact, and then gone home. There is no doubt that the history of Western Europe and the world, for the past 30 or 40 years, would have been radically different. Once the Soviet Union reached nuclear parity with the US in the year 1949, and had American troops not been an integral part of the defense of NATO, Russia could easily have overrun Western Europe by using only its massive conventional forces, after which it could have sat back and dared the US to start a nuclear war over a fait accompli. This seems fanciful today. The American military presence, symbolic of the US commitment, was the only reason that Europe had the courage to withstand the military and psychological pressures of the Cold War. It is doubtful that either Hitler or the Kaiser would ever have started the world wars had they known for certain that America would become. The wisdom of the NATO alliance has borne fruit beyond what anyone could have dreamed. West Germany, the remnant of a nation destroyed, has in a few decades become the number one economic power in Europe, with a standard of living equal to or exceeding that of its American conquerors. As this is written, the supreme accomplishment of NATO, in addition to keeping the peace for 40 years, has been the incredible events occurring in the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact nations. Germany's economic renaissance, the shining example which has caused the disaffection in the Soviet bloc, is due not only to the quality of its people, but the fact that the energies and vitality of the West Germans were not expended in debilitating fear of the Soviets, but were channeled in a positive direction. The an even more spectacular example of the success of the US policy of mutual defense treaties is the case of Japan. Militarily naked, only minutes away from Soviet bases, Japan has had the assurance of a total commitment of the US to her defense, backed up by US armed forces, air, ground and naval, deployed in Japan. Having no worries about her security, Japan has not only beaten her samurai swords into plosives, but also into Toyotas, Sonys, etc., and an endless list of electronic wonders. The speed with which Japan has achieved this transformation has been breathtaking. Not too many years ago, Mitsubishi was not an automobile built by a joint venture with Chrysler, but the most fearsome fighter plane in the Pacific, the Japanese Zero. From a nation in ashes in 1945, Japan has built perhaps the most successful commercial and industrial society in the world. This is not primarily because she spends a relatively small portion of her GNP on defense, but because the talents of her people are unfettered and not disrupted by fears and anxieties about her security. Her creative energies are not stifled under a blanket of fear, but are given free rein to pursue the paths of progress and prosperity. Japan's youth are in laboratories, classrooms and universities, immersed in their new computerized and electronic world, not skulking around the back alleys of West Bank villages. The remarkable case of South Korea following World War II, the Korean Peninsula, by agreement with the Soviet Union, was divided at the 38th parallel into North Korea and South Korea. By 1950, Russia and Communist China were rapidly converting North Korea into a communist satellite, while the US was hopeful that a republic would emerge, Western style, in South Korea. The US was still in the process of sorting out just where, and to what extent, our military commitments should be made in the fluid situation which followed the global dislocations of World War II. It so happens that a highly placed official in the Truman administration was explaining to the press, with the aid of a map, the extent of the US defense perimeter in East Asia. For some reason, deliberate or accidental, the defense perimeter did not include South Korea. This was interpreted in Moscow and Peking to mean that the US was indifferent to South Korean security. Not long after, the North Koreans launched a surprise attack in force on South Korea. The US, realizing too late that a communist South Korea would place the Russians and Chinese on the doorstep of Japan, hurriedly convened a meeting of the Security Council of the UN to meet the emergency. The Russian delegation walked out, thus foolishly missing their chance to veto the Security Council resolution to defend South Korea and repel the invasion from the North. Thus began the Korean War, almost forgotten by many people, but which resulted in American casualties nearly equal to those suffered in Vietnam. The US misled the North Koreans and the Chinese with its ambiguous position, and the North Koreans, in turn, misjudged the US. Neither the US nor North Korea wanted a war. Before it was over, the US had experienced spectacular victories over the North Koreans and crushing defeats at the hands of the Red Chinese. The bloody war, that nobody had wanted or intended, and in which both sides were trapped, ended in a stalemate and the creation of a demilitarized zone, DMZ, on the 38th parallel. Under a mutual defense treaty with South Korea dated October 1, 1953, the US deployed approximately 40,000 troops to guard the DMZ against any new threat from North Korea. This US force is still in place and continues as it has for 35 years in a war-ready state. At the end of the Korean War, South Korea, which together with North Korea, had been an undeveloped backward peasant society and a pre-war colony of Japan, began to build a new nation. The threatening attitude of North Korea toward South Korea never ceased, and has lasted to the present day, although somewhat mellowed. The South Korean army trained and equipped by the US, and the physical presence of 30,000 to 40,000 battle-ready American troops on the DMZ, have stood guard, while the energetic and ambitious South Korean people created a modern miracle. The result was a transformation of a primitive medieval society into a modern, aggressive, and dynamic nation, an economic powerhouse, able to compete in the world markets on even terms with the most advanced industrial countries. It is another example of the unique peacekeeping effectiveness of a deterrent that is clear to all potential aggressors. When there are no surprises, when predatory powers know in advance the consequences of initiating a war, the will to war usually subsides and ultimately vanishes. Israel's security, a solution in Chapter 12, it was stipulated that Israel's security is an absolute precondition to any acceptable peace proposal. The discussion of this all-important topic was deferred to this chapter, where it more properly belongs. The matter of Israel's security is, of course, not a new question, but one that has been raised and considered many times before, and solutions for which have frequently been proposed. In order for the reader to gain a quick insight into how Israel itself views the problem of its security, and why it has rejected various other proposals, we have outlined a short and hypothetical dialogue which incorporates security proposals which have actually been made to Israel at various times, together with the usual responses made by spokesmen for the Israeli government. Security proposal: I don't worry, Israel's security will be guaranteed by the United Nations. Israel's response: we can't trust the UN after all, it was Egypt's Nasser, ordering the UN peacekeeping force out of the Sinai, that precipitated the 1967 war. Security proposal 2. Israel's security will be guaranteed by the United States and the Soviet Union. Israel's response: you don't really expect us to put our lives in the hands of the Russians, do you? Security proposal 3. Very well, then, the United States will guarantee Israel's borders and its security. Israel's response: we appreciate your kind gesture, but you must realize that we would not even have time to dial Washington before we were overrun by an Arab army. They would be only 10 miles away. Not only that, but Congress would have to convene to declare war, and besides that, any real military help is still 4,000 miles away. We can depend only on ourselves. This raises a perplexing question. Why is the US committed, under solemn treaties, to expend unlimited military resources, and, if necessary, to sacrifice the lives of an unforeseeable number of American soldiers, to defend our NATO ally, West Germany, historically not our best friend, or Spain, or Greece, to which we have no special ties, and not to Israel, which does not even have a defense treaty with the US, and is not a formal ally of the US? Why is Israel forced to depend on herself alone? Do we not owe Israel, to which we have many ties, as much security as we give, for example, to Turkey? Are the Japanese and Koreans more deserving of our defense commitments than Israel? While peace and unbounded prosperity are enjoyed by Japanese, Germans, Koreans, and many other countries, under the American defense umbrella, Israel is paralyzed, obsessed, and consumed with fears of the future. Her economy survives only with the aid of a life support system, provided by the US Treasury and the charity of World Jerry. Israel is a nation in siege. The best of her talented people are being drained off to the US and other countries.